In the name of the one and only, let me start with this thought. In the foreverness of the joy of being, being lost and being found travel the length of the same journey. Having arrived is no more than an expectation, where now defies its own self. In the perpetuity of time. In anticipation, there loses its head, trying to escape the reality of the moment at hand. We are at a moment that we should cherish, cherish the presence of those who are with us and those who are connected with us spiritually, rationally, and every other way that they feel comfortable with. Today's talk is Islam between conformity and modernity. And if I may share the screen, that way we could probably explain the topic better. So let me click on the share. Islam between conformity and modernity obviously speaks about transition. And when you transition from point A to point B, sometimes you transition as you are, and sometimes you transition as you become. The two verbs are very important, the being and the becoming. The poem, a short poem I read to you, is talking about the beingness, who we are, how we feel our presence. Which is good if you're enjoying it, and that was also one of the key words there. But while some religions, for instance, in Buddhism, the emphasis is on being, in Islam, the emphasis is both on being and on becoming. It's this becoming part which is talking about the transition. The transition of the soul, the transition of how we evolve, the transition of how we connect to the empowerment of the divine. And if we do connect properly, as we should, then it must have some effect on us. And if we don't, if we don't connect properly, if we don't empower ourselves, then we do not get the enlightenment that we ought to have. So in this presentation, I'm going to share with you some slides, which I hope will facilitate an understanding of this concept. Here, on the left side, we have the Holy Quran. And as you can see, the slide is more in the shape of an arrow. I mean, sorry, that revelation of the Holy Quran is shown in the form of an arrow coming from a higher place to a lower place. And that's what the word nuzul means in Arabic, that the Quran has not just been revealed, but it had been lowered to our level. And this could be both symbolically and in other ways, that the realm of the divine is high up above, wherever it is, it's beyond our reality. And we are down here. And so that's why it has been lowered, in other words, to reach us, but also lowered to our level of comprehension, because the divine is absolute in everything, including in knowledge. And our human knowledge is limited. And therefore, When you, if I can use an analogy, if you're plugging in a different voltage instrument or electric equipment into a different outlet, there might be a problem. So you need a transformer. So going back to the slide, the left side is that the Quran is revealed to us. And we believe as Muslims that the Quran is the last revelation. And if it is the last revelation, then it implies a kind of an eternity. We could connect to it at any time we want to. At the top, we have another arrow that goes from left to right, the orange color one. The colors are fading a little bit. So this one is where there are time-sensitive, time-constrained interpretive studies based on Quran, some of which are studied in fiqh, some in kalam, and some in the various jurisprudential schools that we call the madhab. So these are interpretations or an understanding of the Quran at a certain time and place. And the keywords are time and place. That the great scholars that we have had in Islam, they were great. They faced problems for which they sought solutions. They went to the Quran. They interpreted certain parts of the Quran to find solutions for their problems. Now, the key word here is their problems, which means their problems in their time and in their place. And so therefore, the Quran would remain, just for the sake of argument, the Quran would remain eternal, but the interpretation would not, because the placelessness of the time and space that's in the Quran is not so in our world reality. In other words, in the world reality, there is a placeness, there is a timeness that intrudes into the circumstance and makes things relevant only in that particular place, only in that particular time. Now, these interpretations, of course, like I said earlier, were good for their time. Now, in terms of principles, they would be good for all times, but not necessarily all things were matters of principle. They were matters of situation, matters of circumstance, matters of certain conditions, cultural, social, and otherwise. And those things would then become irrelevant as time passes. Then we move to this other arrow on the right-hand side that's becoming even paler in color. These would be the imitative, where it says the imitative replaces the creative in the course of time. My concentration is on this point here, that if you look at the whole slide, at the upper left-hand corner, that's where things started with the first revelation. Down here in the right, this green zone is where we are now. Now, what has become a tradition in the Muslim world, which in my opinion is an unfortunate one, is that we take the solutions that scholars sought in the past, solutions they had in their time and their place for their problems, and we take those solutions and bring them right into our life. And anytime we have a problem, instead of going directly to the Quran here on the left, which we say Quran has that eternity to it, instead of going to the eternal source, instead of going to the original source, we are rather going to the secondary source. So, for instance, we read in certain place that Imam Shafi said certain things when people asked him about a certain problem. So we use that as a solution when people have problems in our time. we say, oh yeah, here's the solution. It was offered by Imam Shafi, and it applies. The problem is that it may or may not necessarily apply to our circumstance, because our problems might be different. Our time and placeness are different, obviously. And so therefore, while we respect the scholars of the past, we should not imitate them because they were so, just because they were great, because what made them great was their responses to their problems. So when you look down here, there's another arrow, partially broken here, this blue arrow. And I've called this one the missing link, that is directly from Quran to here and now. And this is my argument, is that we have so much of the tradition that the tradition stands between us and the Quran. The traditions of scholarship, the tradition of the jurisprudential schools and all the rest. The more appropriate thing would be for us to look at our problem in our time and in our situation, and instead of going through the indirect way, through the fiqh and kalam and all that, and I don't necessarily mean to dismiss the fiqh and kalam, but the interpretation that were offered in the past, that we go directly to the Quran. And we don't. And that is a problem. Let me show you one more slide. here is one more situation where, again, at the top left corner, this is, would be the time of the Prophet, his circumstance where he lived, and again, the problems that he faced, the solutions that he sought, whether out of his own wisdom or through the revelations. That's what the Prophet did, and perhaps said certain things. So the critical thing here is the did and the said. The did is inclusive of what we know as the sunnah, the way of the Prophet. The say is the hadith part, what the Prophet had said. So the sunnah is the more inclusive one because it includes all of the Prophet's sayings and doing things the way he did it and approving of things that he did the way he did it. And that's the sunnah. However, we have stuck more to what he had said rather than what he had done. And the reason for that is that when we move from the lifetime of the Prophet to the next period, which is the period of the authentic hadith, where people had a firsthand knowledge of what the Prophet had said. But soon after we moved to this time of the great catastrophe, the fitna, where a whole, for lack of a better term, a whole industry of hadith making, hadith writing began. And not just thousands, tens of thousands of hadith were written and attributed to the Prophet. And it was almost impossible to verify. Now, this period would be as much later after the time of the Prophet as 250 to 300 years. And it was a time of crisis in the Muslim world. And people were probably not as strong in faith because the religion was new. But they were strong in terms of committing to the way they understood a particular thing. And we also know from the time of the Prophet and the time right after his life was that the word Prophet was not taken seriously. To many of the Arab chiefs in the peninsula, they said, look, Muhammad was this smart man. He just claimed to be a prophet, whatever he wanted to say, he said it, but he said it that as a revelation, that this was a revelation from God. And look, he established a big state. And so, well, if he could do it, I can do it too. And that's when the period of the false prophets came. And there was not just one or two. It was just a way of sheikhs and rulers and strong-willed men who just wanted to manipulate. Imitate and manipulate, of course, imitate the prophet in an inappropriate way. So during this period of the hadith creation and writing, they wrote so many hadith that they became more in terms of volume and quantity, more than the Quran itself, which made them questionable and seriously. Because for one, if you would have attributed, I think, one particular source lists some 18,000 hadith, if you kind of divide that into the lifespan of the prophet as a prophet, not as a human being, so I'm talking about the last 23 years of his life, he would have been reciting or saying one hadith every few minutes, which is in terms of the circumstance that there was no one to record and to write it down, it would have been impossible. He probably didn't even have time for a revelation. So there's no way that all those 18,000 would have been right, correct, authentic. So these things were attributed to the prophet, these sayings were attributed to the prophet to make a political point or to make an argument or to give strength to one's particular argument. And these arguments could have been political arguments. And that's when the fiqhun and the muhaddithun came, that's in this little small eras and era where they tried to kind of sort these out. They established methodologies. They had certain processes through which they had to test all these hadith for validity, for authenticity, whether they made sense, whether they were in spirit with the divine revelation, whether they were in spirit with the personality of the prophet, and so on and so forth. So this filtration or let's say validation, if you would accept them as such, it took a time. But many of these scholars also, when they went through this whole period, this whole work of authenticating, they included the authentic as well as the inauthentic in their collection. Now, in modern times, most often people say, well, this thing must be so-and-so because I read it in Sahih Bukhari, for instance. Well, he may have read it in Sahih Bukhari, but whether Sahih Bukhari simply listed it as a hadith that he went through his methodology, or whether he accepted it as an authentic one. And that is lost on most. So down the bottom here, we have the Ahlul Hadith. This got to a point where in the course of the historical development, I think I might have to backtrack a little bit, that during the Abbasid period, there was a political upheaval, the Abbasid wanted to kind of unify the jurisprudential school methodologies so that they will have one court system that depended on one particular interpretation in terms of Sharia and understanding of the Quran. And so they want to give a uniformity to their legal system within their political system. that was both a good thing and a bad thing. As much as it may have been necessary to uniform it, the ulama, the scholars, rebelled and rejected the caliphate's suggestion for the uniformity, and simply they were objecting, saying to them that, look, you do your matters of state the way you wish, we will do matters of faith the way we understand. What we understand in the Western world as the separation of state and church, it did not start with the state and church. It started in the Muslim lands between scholars, the ulama, and the politicians. And they wanted to keep these two separate, which in a way is the cornerstone of modern democracy, is the separation of these two, which, as I said, began in the Muslim world. Later, the West copied it in one way or another. And then when Islam was politicized later, not that it wasn't earlier, but more politicized more, came a time when the Western colonial powers had taken over. And at that time, there were several movements of anti-colonial movements in the Muslim world. And one of them started in Arabia by Muhammad Abdul Wahhab. And his experience was that the Arabs of the peninsula had distanced themselves way too far from the Quran. And so when he was trying to bring them back to the Quran, they had trouble connecting. However, when he tried to speak through hadith to them, yes, that there was an Arab like us a long time ago who brought us this revelation, and this is what he said, and this is what he did. When he talked to them through the narrative of the life of the prophet, then they could understand that better. And so because of that, whether it was planned or accidental, the issue of hadith came to the forefront again. And so the end result is that they created what we know today, or we hear about, is the Ahlul Hadith. Now remember, in Islam, in early Islam, there was no such a thing as Ahlul Hadith. The Prophet opposing even the writing down of the hadith for fear that people might confuse the hadith, the prophet saying, with the word of God. And so what they had was the Quran. And if you understood and believed and adhered to the principles of the Quran, that was being Ahlul Quran, not Ahlul Hadith. And if you also adhere to the way the Prophet did things, then that will become Ahlul Sunnah. So in early Islam, we had Ahlul Quran and Ahlul Sunnah, but we did not have Ahlul Hadith, which became a phenomena, political slash religious phenomena of the 18th century Arabia. And this has become so strong that these Ahlul Hadith preachers that are going around the Muslim world, especially to the poor countries, they make belief in the Hadith as part of the faith, as part of one's religion, that if you do not believe in Hadith, you're not a Muslim, which is, in my opinion, blasphemous, and for the following reason, that when we are reading the Quran, أَمَنْتُ بِاللَّهِ وَمَلَائِكَتْهِ وَكُتُوبِهِ وَرُسُولِهِ, there's no such a thing as وَحَدِيثِهِ. In other words, God, the Quran, makes belief in certain phenomenon as part of your faith, which is believing in God, in the hereafter, in the prophets, in the angels, but not in the hadith. However, the Ahl al-Hadith makes that a condition. In other words, they override the Quran and they make the Hadith as condition, saying that unless you believe in Hadith, unless you become Ahl al-Hadith, you are not a Muslim. Which ought to be considered the biggest bid'ah in Islam. And obviously, when you talk to the Wahhabis, they are saying they are against bid'ah, but they are committing the biggest one of those. Now, from the two slides that we looked at, what it shows is how much distance we have created between our souls and the Quran. And this distance is not just the distance of geography and history and time and space, but the distance of concepts is that today's Muslims brag about being Ahl al-Hadith instead of being claiming to be Ahl al-Quran. And just to give you an analogy of this, when you ask a Christian, for instance, about the rules and regulations that they are to abide by in terms of their religious belief system, where do they go? To the New Testament or to the Old Testament? Well, they generally go to the Old Testament. And you would say, wait a minute, that was revealed to Moses, but you seem to be believing in Jesus, so what happened? Well, what happened was that in the Christian period, this pretty much the same thing happened here with a little proviso, which I will explain. The New Testament is basically their Hadith. These are accounts of Mark, Luke, Matthew, and John, who are telling us what Jesus did or how things were reported to them about Jesus. Now, what Jesus said is not anywhere in the New Testament as a direct speech, as a revelation, as the gospel of Jesus. None of that is there. It's the gospel of these four individuals who live 60 to 150 years after Jesus. So then Christianity was devoid of its essential message, which was the gospel of Jesus, which would have been the word of God, which would have been the real revelation. And so they, in this impoverishment, they have no choice but then to go back to the Old Testament. And that's why the old and the new are always put together. Now, what I'm afraid of is that the Muslims are doing pretty much the same thing, that they have made these jurisprudential schools of thought, the Hanafi and the Maliki and the Ja'fari and so on and so forth, as the main source of what they want to connect to when they are looking for finding solutions for their problems. And the Quran has been distanced and it's been put back, so to say, on the back burner, distanced in that way. And so the major problems we have, let me go to the next one, is that this is this historical perspective that when you talk to Muslims, they talk about, you know, in past glory, they see the glory and not the past. Well, the past glory was glorious because it met its circumstance in time and space for what it was. We are trying to apply their problem, their solutions to our problem, and that wouldn't work. They are absent in the present and from the present. In other words, present reality to most Muslims, unfortunately, doesn't matter. And that's why they are irrelevant to modernity, to today's problems, because they rather live in the past. And the past is to be is something to be learned from, not to be lived in. That this change took place here, as you can see in this map, the influence between the 12th and the 21st century. The red line is the the border between where the Muslim and the Christian world were separated. That's how far the Muslims had gone into Europe, through the Balkans, through Eastern Europe, Russia, through Spain, southern France, and all that. That was the 12th century. Now, in the 21st century, that border has been moved south in this blue line, where now we don't necessarily have to look at it in the context of territoriality, but there is also an influence of science, of technology, of being relevant to today's situations and problems and all that. And so we have lost considerably, much more than this geographic division implies here. In that sense, then when we look at it as territorial identification, we talk about the Christian West and the Muslim East. But when we say the Christian West, we are not talking about the East and West in the middle of Europe of the 12th century. Americas, North and South, are all Western. Australia is Western. And in terms of cultural influence, the Christian West is pretty much a global reality. And the Muslim East is shrinking. But what's relevant to our discussion is that when Western Christianity goes to other parts of the world, people often do not see it as Christian, but rather as Western in the context of a culture that is very modern. So you look to this next box at the bottom. So that's modernity and adaptability to the crisis and circumstance. Whereas for the Muslims, that's still traditional conformity. So when Muslims want to conform to a, say, form of government in politics, they go back in time. They don't look into the future. They hardly look into their present. They're all stuck in the past. For instance, our political movements, the Salafis, meaning what? Where does the word come from? From Aslaf. Aslaf means our predecessors. Predecessors mean that we have to go back to the way things were and when, and according to whose interpretation, and how accurate that interpretation may have been. So that's why by retracting or traveling back through history, the Muslims are becoming more and more irrelevant to the world. Modern, Western, Christian, one value, traditional Muslim, East, another. But do they ought to be that way? I think that we could detach those identities, that we don't necessarily have to look at them geographically. And so as you can see in this slide, they could be all over the place. Values are not geography bound. When the Prophet says, "Ta'lamu al-ilma walau kana bis-sin," even if in China seek knowledge, obviously he was not referring to the Han Dynasty or the Song Dynasty or some governments in China in that sense, but rather that knowledge need not be territorial. You have to seek it wherever you can find it. And if we can approach issues that way, like I said, the Muslims have unfortunately allowed the Christian West to claim democracy as a Western tradition. And yet, democracy is not necessarily a Western tradition. Many cultures have contributed to it. My recent paper, is an Islamic State, Islamic, it's at Cambridge University. You can find it online. I have argued this point, the contributions that the Muslims have made to democracy, in fact, are greater, and they are not just greater in number, they're greater in significance. I shared one with you in terms of how Muslims were able to prevent the creation of theocracies in Muslim lands, whereas Christians were not able to. And so they had to come back centuries later to realize what the Muslims had done right. And we are blindly imitating the West in ways where we are doing what the Christians have done wrong. The Christians are doing what the Muslims did right several centuries ago, and the Muslims are doing what the Christian had done wrong, which was creating theocracies, Christendoms. And that's why we see the name of Islamic State and Islamic Republic and Islamic this and Islamic that in so many places. To which, by the way, I'm very much opposed to, because many of these countries don't even deserve the name Islamic to be put in the state government, where these states, this government apparatus, are the most corrupt. And so if you want to put the label of Islamic on it, it ought to be worthy of it. That's, of course, on the literal side of it. But the other reason that I'm against it is that it doesn't have a tradition, neither a command of God in the Quran nor a tradition of the Prophet that we should have a quote-unquote Islamic State. Anyways, that's in the paper for anyone who wants to do more, to read it more thoroughly. Again, How Islamic is an Islamic State is the title. So the primary tension, the global tensions are as follows: that at its zenith, the Muslim East was seen as a threat by its neighbors and was terrorized by crusaders from Europe and by Mongols from Northeast Asia. So Muslims were in the hub, in the center of the world civilization, and they were threatened by the outsiders. Well, now we go to the several centuries later, that at its zenith, the Christian/secular West is seen as a threat by its neighbors and is terrorized by religious extremists from the Middle East and by others. And its economic dominance is challenged by East Asia, at least. And so this has to do primarily with the hegemonic stratification of power in global politics. Anytime that a certain state, a certain political system becomes dominant, some people resented, and some resisted, and the rest we know as history. Here is the next slide, which is regional tensions. The Christian West saw the rise of Islam as a threat to its religious identity and its encirclement as a cause of its economic stagnation. Europe was like this northwest corner of Eurasia, cold climate, not much agriculture, limited food resources, and limited economic opportunities, whereas the Muslims were kind of dominant in the center squares of the global chessboard. They could reach out to China as far east and to Spain in the west and to the eastern coast of Africa. The Muslims were controlling everything. The Mediterranean Sea was basically a Muslim lake. So that was because the Muslims were so dominant, and the Muslim influence was coming west from Russia, from the Kazan and the Ural Mountains, and through the Ottoman Empire, through Balkans, and through Spain, that Christian West, Christian Europe felt threatened, and the threat was Islam and Islamic identity. Now, the Muslim East sees the rise of West as a threat to its religious identity and the exploitation of its economic resources as the cause of its economic stagnation. Again, we are comparing the same geographic areas, in different time spaces with a different balance of power. Again, that hegemonic mentality of being threatened or seeing a kind of a foreignness in others. So one thing what we must note that that the claim of the Muslims is more justifiable because the Christian Europe expanded after the age of colonialism. And colonialism was the result of political economic deprivations, of the poverty of Europe, that they were hungry, they were thirsty, they didn't have resources, they didn't have food, they didn't even have spices. Remember Columbus and the rest of the story? So that when they were able to finally break out of that enclosed northwest cold corner of Eurasia, they went out with a vengeance and they conquered countries, not just for the sake of political or, you know, conquest or religious conversion, but also for their resources. So the Muslim lands fell to the Christians after colonialism. That's why their resources are being robbed and taken and stolen, whether it's the Iraqi oil and gold, and whether it's the natural resources of Afghanistan and so on and so forth. So that part has a validity, to which there was no counterpart in the time when the Muslims were dominant. Because when the Muslims were dominant, the important thing was trade, not the exploitation of raw resources. And yes, it was that trade in foods and silk and in coffee and spices and all that, which the Europeans, you know, as I hinted earlier, wanted to get to. So this role reversal between the 612 and 1400, I'm pointing here to the top of the slide here, and from 1500 to the 2020, the present time, we can look at in these four areas. The Christian West, back 500-600 years ago, they had crusaders who were suicidal, basically. Their mindset was on killing 100 Muslims to go to heaven, which is what the Pope had been preaching. And they saw science against religion. For them, science was a Muslim thing. They didn't want to even get close to it because science was against what they believe. It was against Bible, against the teachings of the Bible. And that's why science was bad, because if we had to validate science, then that would raise questions about the Bible. So the sciences that the Muslims had presented or discovered or invented and all that, science and technology, they would take it only with a grain of salt. And again, in a way where they would not be offending the public mind. And that's why the names of Muslim scholars were always translated into, names were translated into Latin, like Averroes for Ibn Rushd or Avicenna for Ibn Sina and so on, so that the Europeans would consider them at least their own, not foreign. Because if these people had Muslim names, Muslims were dreaded. They were hated. They didn't like them. And so they wouldn't even approach the sciences. Furthermore, much of the scholarship of the Muslim land was written under the name of a particular bishop or a church leader. Not to claim that it was the idea of plagiarism, but to give it a notoriety that they approved of. But because the mindset was so anti-Muslim that anything that the Muslims touched, they would stay away from it. So they hated sciences and only wanted to stick to the Bible. And then they would suppress women in the name of religion, burning at the stake, witch hunts and all that. That's a whole other story. So this is what describes the Christian West of 500-600 years ago. The Muslims were different because they were ethnically inclusive, not just one particular faith or religion, but they were Hindus and Indians and Muslims and Persians and Iranians and Afghans and Central Asians and Arabs and Turks and so on. And then they also built roads and caravanserais that connected them. These were cultural bridges that brought people together. They made advances in science and technology that was responsible for the interconnected so connectedness. So it was an Islamic civilization. I personally don't like the term Islamic for the civilization, but even that term was assigned to the Muslim lands by the Christians. The Muslims believed it more in its universal sense. It had a universality, not an ethnic or religious claim as such. Now, we move 500-600 years later down here to this four square, the square number three. What happened to the Christians of the Dark Ages? Now, they are ethnically diverse, and they are culturally inclusive. They are building highways and byways and information superhighways, and they're advancing in science and technology and all that. And now look at what the Muslims what happened to the Muslim lands. If the Christians were bent on killing 100 Muslims so they could go to heaven, well, Muslims are not that far behind, except that they will have to get to those 72 virgins in paradise. And for that, they have to kill and they have to convert and convert not just just Christians, but anyone who is not Muslim. And in some cases, even people who are not Muslims the way they are Muslims. So these sectarian wars that are going on, for instance, in Yemen and in Syria, for instance, that's because they consider a person, and I have to use this dreaded word, wajib al-qatl, that we have the right to kill them because they are not Muslims. And who gives the verdict? I give the verdict. Unless they believe the way I believe, then they are not. Again, a dark age mentality. So they see science and technology as corrupting. It's a Western thing. We don't do those things. See the exact replica or the exact mirror image of the dark ages that the Christians had. We have adopted it. They suppress women in the name of religion, denying them education, Hajj without mahram, legal guardian and all that, which is no different than what the Christians were doing. So this is a major role reversal. Let me move a little faster in the interest of time. So the distracting secondary tensions are that the Muslim Middle East was threatened militarily by North Asia, and the Christian West may soon be threatened economically by East Asia. That's a kind of a secondary factor that is trying to become primary in some ways. The political perspectives that the dominant culture expands and grows and in times intrudes. And that, again, I refer to it more in the context of hegemonic political power balance. And the second one is that the dominated culture recoils in regression and xenophobia. So we are becoming more regressive in the face of, say, a Western threat. Instead of responding to it in a positive way, instead of learning from them, that's how the West learned. When the Crusaders went to the Middle East, they saw how far behind they were scientifically, technologically, and in other ways. So they adopted their ways. Now, what the Muslims are doing now, it's the same way. They are still regressing. Anything, even if it's good, we reject it out of hand because it's a Western thing. And that may include democracy for many of these despotic governments. And that's why we don't have democracy, because we have, because the West had claimed it to be theirs. And we have accepted that. In other words, we have surrendered it. something that is the common human heritage, of the heritage of humanity, that many cultures have contributed to it. But since the West has claimed it, we Muslims have not only surrendered it as theirs, we're trying to shy away from it also. So the result is that there is regional marginalization and global irrelevance. For who? For the Muslims. So like right now in the midst of the corona crisis, the Chinese are busy trying to find a vaccine. The Germans are busy doing their best, and the Americans, the whole world is trying to find a solution for the coronavirus. And what are the Muslims doing? Well, in some places they are saying, oh, this virus has come only for the kafirs, for the unbelievers. It's not going to affect the Muslims. Let's leave the mosques and things open. And this happened in the earlier months of the spread of the epidemic, unfortunately. And people died by the thousands because of this misinformation, which again was tainted in a very conservative, xenophobic, religious parlance, religious vocabulary. So each shows sensitivity to the expression of the other. And I think I refer to democracy. There's also the word Sharia. So when you use the word Sharia in the West, hair raises in the back of their head and say, in the back of their neck, and you ask them why, you say, well, that's an Islamic thing. And if you ask them, well, do you want to know what it is? And you explain to them, or you ask them what is common law in Western legal tradition, then they find out that, well, Sharia is no different than common law. It's just that the sensitivity is to the word. And so in certain ways, it's these cultural sensitivities. The sociological perspective is that there are bundled entities, entangled identities, that Western European culture, Christian religion, is somehow associated with modernity, and then the Islamic East with Islam as a religion and as a tradition, and this new Islam, the Hadith Islam. And so these have been bundled together. And so the result is that when you have to choose between the East and the West, you can throw in any of those words, and somehow, not accidentally somehow, but as I explained, that all the negative ones are the ones that the Muslims are attracted to and can relate to, the regression, the backwardness, and all that. And the Christians just take the opposite pole. Psychological perspective is that there is a selective modernity. Like we have Muslims who are technophiles with retarded perspective, which is what I call often as a joke, as the Hadith on the iPhone, is that when it comes to modern technology, the Muslim will have the latest version of, say, the iPhone, the smartphone, whatever. And then you ask them, like, what do you use it for? What do you have in it? Oh, I have all the Hadith downloaded into my phone, and I can read them morning and day and whenever I want to. So in terms of technology, we're attracted to it, but in terms of how we use it, it's not there. Or the terms, traditions, if I could call it that, the arranged marriages in the West. Again, if you look at it, that arranged marriage will be un-Islamic because you would have to, when you have the Aqd and the Nikah, it's an agreement between two parties. And for the two parties, both persons would have to make their own choice on their own. If they didn't have the choice, the ikhtiyar, the right, the freedom, that marriage will not be valid. And yet, we go to the arranged marriage and we call it Islamic because it comes from some backward Muslim country. And then those people who move over here to the West, to a more modern society, they don't come along. They bring that whole baggage with them. So there is a wholesale acculturation. On the one hand, you have pop music, blue jeans, Christian names, and you know, the whole nine yards, that on the appearance, they look very, very Western. But they still do honor killing, honor killings even in the West. So the Muslim youth is lost in the present and irrelevant. They're lost in the past. They're irrelevant to the present. And the Muslims adults, they're obsessively religious and radically political. Now, when I say religious, I mean by religious-minded. I am not using a religion by itself as a stigma. But the way you approach it, being religious-minded in the sense that you are close-minded, that you are not looking at things critically, rather you look at it imitatively. And so long as you imitate, remember the first slide, you're applying somebody else's solution to somebody else's problem, not to your problems. So in an overall analysis, we can say that the Muslim East is doubly suppressed. There is a political suppression, there is economic suppression, there is global suppression of the political systems, but then they are socially suppressed right within their own society. The suppression of the woman by men, suppression of the poor by rich, and so all these are suppressions because democracy is not there, civil rights are not there, human rights are not there. All of these are things that the Quran had recommended, but because we have taken distance from the Quran, then that's the way things are. They see Islam more as a cultural identity than as a religious identity. So the Islam of the Sunnis and the Shiis would be one thing, but the Muslims of the Pakistanis, the Islam of the Pakistanis versus the Islams of the Egyptians, for instance, you know, how you hold your hand or you don't hold your hand when you're praying, or how you wash your hands. These are trivialities that they are preoccupied with. Now, between nostalgia and dream, they gaze at the present that doesn't mirror a reality. And so, again, this would be much more, requires a much more thorough explanation, but I'm trying to finish it up so we can stick within the time limits, and then there will be some issues might come up in the Q&A later. So they live in self-imposed alienation, for instance. We are talking about Muslims who come here to the West, which provides all the rights and liberties that a civil society should. And yet they live in enclaves. They live in smaller enclosed communities, as if they were, say, in Afghanistan, as if they were still in Indonesia or in some other place where there the political system is enclosing them, encircling them. And here they do it to themselves. So the transcultural icons living in two worlds, but detached from both. So they come from the East, they live in the West, but in reality, they are neither of the East nor of the West. So they consider any deviation from cultural norms as a deviation from religious principles. And again, the cultural norms are defined culturally, geographically, within a particular country that may or may not necessarily be Islamic, but that's what matters to them. So say if their daughter wants to get married, if the man is Algerian, then he must marry an, she must marry an Algerian. Otherwise, forget it. So the symptoms of conformity, then Muslims equate modernity with Westernization and end up resenting one because of the other. In an attempt to be un-Western, they retreat to past glories of the East and become detached from the present reality. So in conclusion, Muslims must define modernity in its own right, Quranically. Muslims must own modernity. They were at the cutting edge of modernity for centuries, the longest civilization of any part of human geography was theirs, and they were at the forefront. And now they are not even at the bottom. I think they're probably worse than that, but I will leave that. So let me end up the presentation part of it. And if there are questions, I would like to entertain those, and so we'll go to the Q&A.
And if you look in the chat box, there are some of the questions posted there.
So let me move this. Oh, the chat box. That would be, where is the chat box? Okay.
It should be on the left of that green shirt. Green button.
So how much the, I think that is not Wasabi, it's Wahhabis, affect the main street of Islam. It's not that how much they affect. What matters is what part of it they affect. Saudi Arabia is a conglomerate of both a political dynastic hierarchy that has been endorsed by a particular sect, the Wahhabis. And so when the poorest parts of the Muslim world, say Afghanistan, Yemen, Pakistan, Somalia, when they are in need, the Saudi government is willing to send them a check, tons of money. And oftentimes it's with strings attached. Along with it comes the Wahhabis. So they are very influential in the poorest parts of the Muslim world. And when people are poor, they are generally more religious. And again, they're more religious minded. Whether they do it right or wrong, that's a different thing. So I think the problem is there, that most of the extremists that come in on the global political scene come from the, exactly these poor countries, poor areas of the Muslim world, where the Saudi money had enabled Wahhabi thinking to become kind of the mainstream of their mindset. The next question, could you enter full screen? We did that. Okay, from audience. How much? Okay, I think I answered that one. What is the way out of this mess? Well, I don't know if you're really meant to ask that question, because I don't seem to have an answer. There is a saying, it's a joke, that someone told a camel that your neck is crooked, and the camel laughed. I don't know how it laughed, but it responded, said, like, what part of my body is not crooked? Well, in the Muslim world, there are so many things that are wrong, that it would have to require a revolution. And the revolution would have to be in the mind. And if you noticed, my talk was mostly about the past, but I was critical of it. And that was deliberate, because my next talk, which I think is next week, it's going to be more into the future. What can we offer? What solutions are there? How to identify our problems. The important thing is identifying a problem correctly, and then having people who are equipped to understand it and come up with a solution. I think at this stage, most of us have not even identified the problem correctly. To a lot of places, like when you say, like, why is this thing happening? They say, oh, because you know, Muslims are not going to the mosque anymore, because they are not reading the Quran anymore. And the problem may have nothing to do with the Quran or with the mosque. The problem might be just a social problem. It might be a political one, for which even a common sense might offer a solution. Not that the Quran wouldn't present the principles of it, but how we apply it. So I think we are either not defining our problems correctly, and we are certainly hesitant in delving into a future where we can offer an answer, a response to our problem. I think that's why we are too much stuck in the past. Are these slides available to share? Well, since they become part of the recording, when the video is ready, I'm sure they will be there. Next question, can we have your speech at your website? Yeah, when it's recorded, I will post it on my website as well as on my Facebook. Let's see. The slide containing different responses society makes them what? Recall and regression. When you look at the fall, now let's take the Christian Muslim identity out of it. Almost every empire that collapses, I'm talking about the huge hegemonic empires, the ones that have collapsed, they have usually collapsed from within. They have felt insecure and they have denied their own people the freedoms, the creativities, the critical thinking, and the result is their downfall. Look at the, I'll just give you this one example. Look at India. Under Mughals, they established the Council of the Niners, where the north, nothing will become part of a law and a rule unless it was approved by the nine, the religious leaders of the nine largest religious communities in India. And only then it will become law. This would imply that there was a lot of religious pluralism. There was a lot of respect for different religions. And that's why Jalaluddin Akbar, for instance, called it Deen Ilahi. He says, God's religion, and that would be the umbrella identity for all of them. Compare Jalaluddin Akbar's time with Aurangzeb's time. When they felt kind of insecure within, all of a sudden they came and imposed jizya tax on the Hindus. Of course, they alienated all the Hindus. Then comes the British and the others. So the more conservative they became, the more they were digging their own grave. And that's the case with most of them. Look at the fall of the Soviet Empire. So I think in that sense, the recoiling and the regression is a natural thing that when certain governments and states feel that they would, that they are threatened, they deny the people the creativity and the human rights and the democracy and all that. In other words, they create their own opposition, strengthen their own opposition within their own states. Do you see glimmers of hope for change to the current situation that present? We should never give up on hope. However, we have to have an open mind. We Muslims are not emphasizing the hope. All the emphasis is on prayers. And even the prayers are done the wrong way, because it's basically giving God Almighty orders to do this and do that and do the other. God doesn't do a thing for us. God is not supposed to do a thing for us. Why? Because God give us the brain, the head, the thinking, the body enabled us. God gave us the consciousness. God gave us the intelligence. God gave us all these things. He's like, now go and do what is right. Those were ancient gods that were worshipped out of fear. We still worship God out of fear, not out of love, which is wrong. And in the same way, because we fear them, because we think they are in control of everything. Yes, in principle, of course. But if God was to do anything for us, it will defy our essential right that God has given us, which is our right to have the freedom to choose. So we can do right or wrong, God empowers us. And God empowers us because the choice is ours. And we don't make use of our choice to do the right thing and not do the wrong thing. Instead, we are just sitting back and we are just praying. And God Almighty, sorry to personify this, is saying like, well, why are you asking me? I give you the intelligence. I give you the knowledge. I give you all the things you needed to. What's wrong with you? Why are you in ghafla? Why are you asleep at the wheel? Get up and do it. We are not, in the minute the word dua comes, it implies in the common mind, in action. And I'm not saying we shouldn't do dua. That's a whole other lecture if it becomes necessary, how to do a dua. Dua is when you invite God into your life. That's dua comes from dawah. Dawah is invitation. You invite God in, not give God orders for things that you're made capable to do. Sorry, I'm answering these questions not as thoroughly as I would like to, because of time, but I'll try to answer as many as I can. And some of these questions, if I didn't answer, again, you can plug in the next week's lecture. They could come up there. Let's see. This one, I think that's a little more detailed. So let me skip that one. Does modernizing have any basis from a textual approach from the Quran and the Sunnah and Islam and scholarship? Of course, every religion, in my opinion, is a revolution. When a religion comes, it goes straight at the status quo. It questions people's beliefs. And it questions the validity of it, the pointedness or the lack of it. And that's why every religion comes as a revolution, because it turns the society upside down, because it offers new solutions, new alternative way of thinking. And so the nature of religion is to be revolutionary, to demand change. And that's why the Quran is clearly saying, don't go after the tales of your grandfathers. There's nothing wrong with going to the tales and the Asatir al-Awaleen and the whole concept there. Yes, go to it, learn from it, but come back to the present and move on to the future. And what we do is that we go to it, we go to the past, and we are stuck there. We are not even coming to the present, let alone going to the future. Let's see what else. Next. I'm trying to look for questions rather than the comments. How do you get rid of the cultural practices that are detrimental to the practice of Islam? You don't get rid of the cultural influences. Islam has its own culture, and there are subcultures, and there is no problem. You simply adopt to the new culture. Prophet Muhammad was a Meccan. Traders, businessmen, and people who had to do business with, with the shrine, with the Kaaba, and all that. He came to Medina, which was an agricultural, an agrarian society. It was an oasis. There was no trade, but there was agriculture. There was, a very, very different kind of circumstance. So what did he do? He adopted to this new lifestyle. When we go to a different culture, we can accept the ways of the culture. We have to acculturate ourselves. And the culture is not necessarily part of Islamic. No culture is anti-Islamic. There might be certain practices that might be so. So I think when we move to a new culture or from any culture, we can change, we can adopt certain of their ways and make them part of Islamic religious belief system. They're not necessarily contradictory. Give details on examples of modernizing Islam. Let's see, if you look at the modernization, the first thing we have to go is to go to sciences. Most of our education in the Muslim lands is not an Islamic education, and for the most part, it is not even South Asian or Middle Eastern education. This is Western education. The curriculums are the ones that were designed here in the West, in America or in Europe. We adopt them. All we have to do is to translate them into Urdu and Arabic and Farsi and think that, okay, now it's ours. It's not. And then when you go to the Islamic curriculum, all they have to do is send people to madrasas to recite and memorize and read Ibn Taymiyyah and things that are, if not totally, for the most part, irrelevant for our times. So the religious education doesn't do a thing for us. The modern education is a transplanted Western education. And not that there are certain things like, you know, math, science, chemistry, those things that are universal. But there are certain other ways of approaching them that, you know, we have to allow a certain degree of creativity. Take, for instance, the Khidmat movement of the Gulen, the Khidmat schools of the Gulen movement from Turkey, which is a looking at modern problems from a modern perspective and applying modern technology and modern sciences to solve them. They have more than 1,000 schools. And now, where do you think their schools are? Not necessarily all in the so-called Muslim societies. They have schools in China, they have schools in Central Asia, in Africa, in the worst part of the world in terms of political stability. They have places, they have schools. They are educating the girls. They are, you know, things that some traditions would not allow. They do that. But it's unfortunate that they have got into an entanglement and many of their schools have been confiscated either by the Turkish government, taken over by the Turkish government, or they have been confiscated by some corrupt governments in these parts of the world. And so that's why you take the principle, an Islamic principle, a Quranic principle, which is learn, educate yourself. But that doesn't necessarily mean that you have to sit and keep reciting the Quran. Why do you need to? Our whole emphasis is on, for instance, when you go to most of these Muslim societies, you get invited to Khatm Quran. What is that supposed to mean? Well, you go and you sit there and they are reading and reciting the Quran as fast as they can so they can finish it, Khatm, end it. It's not supposed to be khatamd, if I can coin a word here. You're supposed to start it. You're supposed to open it. You are supposed to get into it. You're supposed to get some meaning out of it. That's what tabir is. Get a meaning out of it and apply it to your life. Most Muslims don't do that. Whether they recite it and finish it in the month of Ramadan, or when they do it in some of these rituals for the funerals and all that, in my opinion, the greatest disrespect happens to the Quran in these religious communities, where it's recited and nobody listens. When if they listen, nobody translates it. When it's translated and read to them, nobody is allowed to ask questions. For instance, the khutbah arrangement. Everybody's supposed to be sitting dead silent and just listen. And in many cases, not in many cases, in some cases, the man over at the altar is saying perhaps the most nonsense things there is, but nobody can say, wait a minute, what part of that was in the Quran? And so therefore, our religious education is way, way backward. Our secular education is not designed to solve our problems. They are creating technocrats in many societies to work through the government apparatus, and most of the governments and states are very corrupt. So it's the most quote-unquote educated that are responsible for the most corruption in most of these governments, unfortunately. And we could talk about that next week a little bit more as to where do Muslim societies stand in terms of corruption versus, adhering to moral principles, to moral values, to righteousness, to akhlaqiyat is what we often refer to. Let's see, what about those that are in direct opposite of the teachings of the Prophet? how women are treated in such Asian cultures. Yeah, the problem with the problem is not with the women. The problem is with men and their masculine and male thinking, where in some of these backward societies, they think that if a woman doesn't dress properly, it is bad for their own belief. Give me a break. If you are a good believer, you can look at a woman all you want to. The lust, the sin, is not in the way a woman dresses. It is in your eyes, and it's in your heart, and it's in the lack of your morality, and it's in the weakness of your faith. So don't hold her responsible. It's repeated 7 times in exactly the same verses. You are responsible for your action, not for someone else's action. As far as I'm concerned, I can pray with the naked woman right in front of me. If the sin doesn't occur in my eyes and in my heart, and if I'm really praying, I wouldn't even see that there is a woman, let alone her being naked, because I'm with God. But if I'm not with God, then I should not be pretending that I'm praying. Then I'm doing something wrong in the first place. So it doesn't matter where that woman is. That woman could be even fully dressed. The woman may not even be present there. And I could use my imagination in a sinful way, in the wrong way. And so how am I supposed to stop that? So if I don't have the fortitude, the moral fortitude of my own personality, I shouldn't blame it on how somebody else walks or talks. I think I heard one particular case where a person was beaten up in public in a village square because the person had a Facebook page where he gave himself the name of a woman and probably put a woman's picture. And so the clergy came and said this is impersonation and it's wrong, and they were beating the guy to hell. So because the man may be wearing certain kind of clothes, however he might be standing in the mosque, nobody questions that. Like, on what authority? And what was wrong? What was violated? Who was hurt? Sorry, I'm getting more into the preaching rather than the teaching. So let me see if there are more questions that I can answer here. Isn't it better to read the Quran in your native language so that you can get the most out of it? Yeah, there's nothing wrong with it. I would say read it in any language you want to. When it becomes critical or questionable and you're not sure, then you may want to have the Arabic next to it, so that we know that the in terms of authenticity, it's the Arabic that counts. But if you read it in Portuguese and you understand it better, no problem. I read it in English most of the time. I think we should even pray in English or whatever language you want to. If you're connecting with God, God is not an Arab. That was only a medium. Arabic is the language of the Prophet, not the language of God. And there is no holiness attached to Arabic itself. Quran is not the language. It's not the logha. It's called kalam. Kalam is the words that carry the meaning. So it's the meaning that is important, not the form and the shape and the style and the grammar and the paragraph and the sentences and so on. Let's see, I got some points on modernization, so that probably comes in the next talk. Why are women more revered in Islam, considering the first followers of Islam was a woman? I love women. The Prophet loved women, and that for me, that is a sunnah. Women are beautiful in appearance, in their spirituality, in their religiosity, in their humanity, in their nurturing, in their raising the power, in their sustaining of life. They give life, they give birth, they know the meaning of it. I wish that women take over all the political systems in the world. Look at most of the death and destruction, the warfare, everything that is happening is done because of, by men. It's the men are violent. We can call it by nature, but I don't know, I have to question that. But when you look at women in their true essence, there are a lot of beauties. But in most societies, men treat women as second-class citizens. The degrees differ, but it's there in every society, including the most advanced Western societies. So I think we should even worship women, because next to God on the face of earth, they are the ones who give us life. God is the Khaliq. Women are the Khaliq Bawasta. They are the means for the creation, for the procreation, for the giving of life, for the nurturing. If women were not there, where would humanity be in the early years of our life? So when I'm talking about the beauty of women, this is how we have to understand women in their true essence. For most men, unfortunately, woman is an object. A woman is objectified. A woman is for the pleasure of men. A woman is for all these other fantasies that men create. And I'm sure women have their fantasies too, except that men have a bit more power in acting upon it. So because of that, when men abuse women, the result is it's the woman's fault. In some societies, even today, in the 21st century, women are stoned for what? For adultery. And nobody asked the question that how could a woman commit adultery all by herself? If she couldn't commit adultery by herself, where is the man involved? And how many men have been stoned? Not so. So the woman is abused, the woman is violated, and then the woman is held responsible for the man's action, and then the man is given all the freedom to go and do whatever he wants to, and it's the woman who eventually pays with her life for that. And so in some countries, I won't mention it, that if a woman is charged with zina, with adultery, they are even, I'm sorry to put it so bluntly, they are gang raping her, because she must have done something wrong that she was subjected to such an abuse. Don't take me there. I'm getting a little too emotional there, but let's move on to, we have a lot more questions. There are women in power in our current day who have been very destructive. Yeah, I agree with you. Those are not the women I'm talking about. There are men in women's body. They are playing men's game. They are playing men's politics, power politics. They campaign as men. They come to power as men. They act like men. And so they have to outdo other men in order to be accepted. That's why some of the greatest wars of our modern time were declared by women. Whether it was Margaret Thatcher's armies going thousands of miles to the Falkland Islands, to Malvinas, to fight the Argentinian, whether it was Golda Meir whether it was Indira Gandhi. They were great men warriors in women bodies who wanted to prove to other men that they are like men. I think the woman, you know, we need women who are not just feminine in the body, but who are feminine in spirit, and who run for government and who control government in terms of feminine values, not masculine values. So we have to make that distinction. And I might throw this also that when we are talking about feminism, it is not necessarily the monopoly of women. You could be physically masculine, and it could be more feminine than the women in some cases. I take myself one such example. I hope that answers that question. Let's see, do we have any more questions? I might have skipped that because the list here is pretty long. So let me do one thing. I'll copy these questions. I'll go over it. If I have skipped any, I might include that in the next lecture next week, which for those of you who may not know, has to do more with the stigmatization of critical thought in Muslim societies. One of the questions earlier was that, you know, where do we go from here? What is the solution? How do we take care of this problem? And I think the main thing is that we do not respect in the Muslim world, in the so-called Muslim world, we do not respect people's humanity, their integrity, and their awakened consciousness. The political suppression does not allow for free thinking, for critical thinking. And it's because of that, I think, for the most part, that we are where we are. So I don't know, I have time until about 6 o'clock, another 4 or 5 hours. But I'm sure that some of you, most of you probably already got bored, so I wouldn't torture you more than this. We will see you next week in the next talk. I hope you all have a nice day. Thank you.